G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. And I am speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
Good day to you too.
Nice to have you back on, my friend. We're kicking off from 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 17. You let me read 17 last week. I snuck that one in, but I'm going to read it again just to bring us back up to speed. Because it says, then Shaul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Yoel, Yehonatan, Jonathan, and his armor-bearer were not there. And that reminds everybody, of course, that, you know, they went and picked a fight, right?
Yeah, they went out by themselves. By the way, it doesn't say Yehonatan, it says Yonatan.
Yonatan, Yonatan.
Where the ho is, the hey is dropped out of the name. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot. Like I mentioned last time, you know, Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyah, Yishayahu, Yishayah. You have these cases where you drop the hey for some reason. Yeah, remember, hey is a very weak sound in Hebrew, and it happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That aleph and hey can drop. For example, et, which means the, which doesn't exist in English, but et, mm-hmm. suddenly becomes ta. And I was actually in everyday life, spoken Hebrew, people say instead of et, they say ta.
Ta, really?
Ta, something. And I actually discovered that there's a few manuscripts that do the same thing, ancient manuscripts that, you know, we're talking about First Temple period stuff, that actually do that as well. So corruption of language that we're experiencing now is the same corruption of language they had thousands of years ago.
Ah, okay. But in any case, hello to Yehonatan, Prince Halevi the Fourth. He's there, right? He's happy? He's happy little
boy?
Yeah,
he's next to me. He's playing. He's going to drive me mad throughout the recording because he's insisting I have to move things around with his toys as well.
That's all right. You can do that. But you have your Yehonatan there, whereas Shaul didn't have his Yehonatan. And he and Shaul, Saul, said to Ahiah, is that right? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, his name is Ahiah.
He said, bring the ark. Bring the ark of God here. For at that time, the ark of God was with the children of Israel. And that reminds me, Yoel.
I don't think he means bring the ark. It actually might mean go. Let's go to the ark. Hagisha Aron Elohim. Hagisha doesn't necessarily mean bring forth the ark, but let's go to the ark.
Okay, but the ark is in Kiryat, isn't it? Isn't it in Kiryat Yair?
No, Kiryat Yair is later on. The ark at the moment is traveling somewhere around the world. After Shiloh was destroyed, we don't really 100% know exactly where it was. And there actually is a version that doesn't have the word the ark.
Okay.
It actually skips the whole thing. Because the ark was usually brought out at times of battle, but when it's not very clear, you know, suddenly the ark shows up. And it's not very clear because this is like a very flaky battle. They're not really there, so it might be the priest said, and we're not going to bring the ark with us, specifically after the trauma of Shiloh.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. But see, I'm looking in 1 Samuel chapter 7. It says in verse 1 and 2, and then the men of Kiryat Yaim came and took the ark of Yehovah and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and what's this? Consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the Ark of Yehovah.
Yeah, but this is decades before the story we're dealing with now.
Sure.
So we don't exactly know, and there's also a possibility that it was in Nov, which comes up in later on in the stories of David, and
okay.
There was a temple there as well. The question is, was this like the temple? Or was this another holy city, and
sure,
they had like a whole bunch of stuff going on there? But there is an issue with that, because Achimelech walks around with bread, the show bread,
mm-hmm.
which means there's a possibility that this is the bread before the Lord, which mm-hmm. means the ark as well is should be there as well. So we don't really know where the ark is yet.
That's a really good point.
But the one way to figure this one out is if we actually skip when David takes the ark to take the ark to Jerusalem the first time, and it should mention, if I remember correctly, where he picked it up from.
So while you're finding that, what this reminds me of is the sons of Eli who asked for the ark to be brought to the battle, and they lost it. They lost it there, and that was against the Philistines as well, right?
Yeah, that was the battle against the Philistines, yes.
Was Shaul about to make the same mistake? I mean, was that a mistake?
Well, it says here that it was in Giv'ah, which is the house of Avinadav in Giv'ah,
uh-huh.
which is interesting, because didn't we say it was Kiryat Yearim?
Yeah.
Let's go back for a second.
That's in 7, 1 and 2.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to 7 for a second. No, it's in Givan. Okay, Atiyarim. Okay, so we established now clearly that the Ark is in the house of Abinadab, which does raise a question here. Was it always there? Did they take it occasionally? I mean, there's a good possibility that they tried to protect the Ark as much as they could, which meant, it's in the house of Abinadab and that's it.
So the house of Abinadab is in where?
Giva.
Ah, okay.
Kiryat Yarim is later on. It's after the first attempt to put the Ark in Jerusalem or Zion. Uh-huh. It goes to Kiryat Yarim for a short while.
Okay, so I'm with you. All right, so there you go.
In any case, so there's an interesting thing that happens here. So he goes to the Ark,
Does he go to the Ark? Or is he saying, bring the Ark here? Or what's going on?
I personally think Hagisha is let's go to the Ark. It doesn't mean bring the Ark. It's go. Let's go to the Ark. Okay. You don't bring the king to you. You go to the king. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that it's in the rest of the verses. Ki haya aron Elohim bayomo uvnei Israel means the Ark was with. There's a bit of an issue of syntax here, but the Ark was there and the children of Israel means they were together. The Ark was actually in the camp. Okay. But there is a question. There's a question. Okay, what is he trying to do? So the next verse. Basically, the next verse goes that it says Vayia Daber Shaul el Kohen, and it was until the Saul spoke to the priest. Suddenly, he's not just Achia; he's now the Kohen. Okay, mm-hmm. Very important shift. Mm-hmm. You have to remember sometimes when we change a name or something, or we shift into slightly different mode, it means that okay, now he's a Kohen. Remember, if you remember when Judges, we had the same thing. We had that Levite, Yehonatan.
Yes.
And he is called the Levite. And suddenly when he functions as an oracle, I'm going to use the name oracle here, mm-hmm. he's suddenly a Kohen. So we have the same shift. Mm-hmm. He's now not Achia, he's now the Kohen. They're talking about the camp of Philistines. And then suddenly he says, Vayomer Shaul la Kohen asof yadecha. So we have a break here in the middle of a verse, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it says, and Saul said to the Kohen, collect your hands, basically stop. Asof yadecha, the yad, the hand, represents the concept of action. And uh-huh. he says, collect your hands, basically stop, cease doing what you were doing. So there's a question, what exactly is going on here?
So in other words, cancel that order.
Yeah, exactly, 86 that. Mm-hmm. It's a restaurant concept. basically what you have is... there's a question that has to be raised here. So I'm going to venture into something, and I know this is not really everything to do with the verses we have here, but I have to go into this because I have to clarify a whole bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. So what exactly is going on here? What is the Kohen actually doing? So if we go back into Exodus, we have this concept called the Urim and Tumim, the Urim and Thummim, mm-hmm. Urim and Tumim. And a lot of people, and specifically in the rabbinic tradition, say that what they were doing is quite asking in the Urim and Tumim. There's no prophet around. At least Samuel's not around. This is a war that Saul is venturing into by himself without Samuel. Mm-hmm. Samuel got very, very angry with him previously. So he's doing everything by himself. So he's trying to secure himself. The logic is he brings the ark in. I have the ark with me now. He hasn't learned the lesson that the ark is not a juju. You can't just push a couple of buttons and it works. It doesn't work like that. That's the exact opposite of what Torah is. Unlike witchcraft and stuff like that, it's the concept of we're going to press a couple buttons and it's going to make something work out in the world. It doesn't work like that. God has a will of his own. You can't manipulate God. There's no sympathetic magic here. You can't grab God by the beard, so to say, you're going to do this. That's how the ancients used to perceive the gods. You grab the God by the beard or by whatever and tell him what to do. Here, God's basically saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to run the world the way I think it should be run. But he's basically standing there, and there is one of the opinions is that they're using the Urim and Tumim, but there's a big question. What is the Urim and Tumim? So if we go to Exodus, it talks about the ephod and the choshen, the breastplate and the apron of sorts. Mm-hmm. But basically, actually, really one. They're one thing. They come together. The apron keeps the breastplate up. So many descriptions say that the apron was just around the legs. It really was probably almost like a back thing. It really mostly covered the back. Mm-hmm. And then the choshen was attached on the front with this back piece holding it together.
Sure.
Almost like an armor of sorts or something like that. And Josephus actually goes into this whole thing. It was very golden, so it looked like a golden armor. But I think he was just trying to tell people, oh, he looked like the armors of the gods. I think that's what Josephus was actually really trying to do. But in any case, there's a few questions about this. So what exactly are the Urim and Tumim? Some people say Urim Tumim, Urim from the root of Or, light, and Tumim from the root of Tom, complete or something. Some people think it might have been two rocks or two slabs of rock that were put inside the Choshen because the Choshen was folded together, mm-hmm. and the Kohen would put his hands in and pull one of them out, and they might have to do it three times or something. Some people say these were little pieces of wood or something with writing on them, and you put his hand in and pull out, and whatever comes out will be the answer. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of speculations about this. There's also the opinion, the rabbinic opinion, which is also highly emphasized by Rav Saadia Gaon, which is that the Urim and Tumim are actually the rocks on the breastplate, and that they were that when they asked the question, they would glow. And
so I have heard that one. I have to be honest, Yoel, I'm kind of going with the first explanation that you gave, that there were some kind of lots that were used, which was part of the equipment of the priest.
Yeah, there is, because any priest in the ancient world was also an oracle, and mm-hmm. they would ask, these were always yes or no questions.
Mm-hmm.
There was never complex questions where you can ask something very specific. But in the rabbinic tradition, it was very funny. A friend of mine said to me yesterday, and you know who you are, 2 days ago, that the Samaritans claimed that they invented the idea that the rocks, the stones with the letters would glow. But this stuff is older than the Samaritans.
Sure.
But in the rabbinic tradition, the stones had the breastplate, and there were stones with names, and you had most of the alphabet there, and mm-hmm. They claim it will glow. The problem with this is that it kind of puts everything in the world in the miraculous thing. Now, if it would glow, then people always knew, oh, okay, God is always here. The thing is, the Romans, the Greeks, the rest of the nations always claimed the same things. And when Oracle will do, they're going into some ecstatic spiritual state or something, and that will always be proof that the God is with them. And I heavily, heavily, heavily doubt that any of this was actually, real. It's mostly probable that what happened was that the priest would put his hand into the breastplate, pull out whatever it was, and the answer would be there. And if, for example, two slabs of stone, one white and one black, white would be yes, black would be no, or something.
Sure.
Your hand, now you have to pull out the same color three times. And if you pull out different colors each time or something, then it's a confused answer.
Because we come into an example here where God does not answer Saul. We'll get to that. But either it is yes, it is no, or you get no answer. So there's three options, right?
There are three options. Now, also, there's also a discussion. I want to venture into one more thing before we continue. There is a discussion of shatnez, wearing mixed garments, mixed cloths.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I bring this up on Facebook a couple of times, that we traditionally say that shatnez means not to mix wool and linen, and that there's a problem with the translation. The English translations usually say such as, where the Hebrew does not say such as. The Hebrew says not to wear shatnez, linen and wool together. Wool and linen together. So it raises the question of, okay, what goes on with the priestly garments? Because in the tradition is that blue, the royal blue, the tchelet, and the argaman, okay, are both on wool, but you also have shesh, which is a type of linen. It's a very thin, fine type of linen. So how do you weave these things together if the Torah forbids wearing shatnez?
Are they actually woven together, or are they separate garments on the priest?
Because the breastplate, the ephod, the choshen, these were mixed together. If you read the verses in Exodus, it says, and you do twine together as one string, and that's how you weave this. It was a mixed colors in it. Huh. So I was looking into this because there's a lot of questions. Is it shatnez? Is it not shatnez? And you have the whole history of what is the royal blue and everything. But in the ancient world, specifically if they were coming out of Egypt, the Egyptians didn't use wool. That's number one. So it's very strange that you say that they had pre-prepared colored fabrics or dyed unprocessed cloth or whatever it might be, that they would contain wool. Now, also the other thing is that the blue, the substance that's used in the rabbinic tradition for the blue, comes from a very specific sea creature.
Yep.
Which I don't think there's an issue of it being not kosher and everything. I really heavily doubt there's a problem here, because you're not eating it. But there is a discussion of, you know, it says you would keep their, I'm trying to think what the translation of tishaketsu would be, but you basically spur the bodies, you know, you look at them in disgust and everything. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, in Ezekiel, he mentions tchelet mi'elisha taviu, says, you know, something like that, tchelet mi'elisha, the blue, the royal blue from the Isles of Elisha, which is Cyprus. And we know that in the Mediterranean area, they would produce the blue dye from sea creatures as well.
Oh, sure.
But the thing is that there's also, it's a question of, is it a color or colorant? And I think I spoke about this some time ago. But there is an issue that there's some people claim it's forbidden to the regular lay person, but the priests were commanded to wear clothing like this. But on the other hand, instead of going, getting twisted and get your neck injured by twisting in different ways, it's actually easier. We also know of plant-based colorants which were used to dye linen.
Sure.
So there's a good chance that the priests wore only linen. So everything they wore was linen. Literally every little piece was linen, which makes it easier to explain, okay, how come you have these different colors? Also have to remember that the word tchelet and argaman are not really Semitic words. Uh-huh. Specifically argaman. Argaman is really an Hindu word, which is ragaman. Which means there is a very old theory that says that these dyes actually came, the original origins of concept of dyeing these fabrics in blue and red and purple and all these colors actually comes from India, where they actually use plant-based substances and also dyed anything that exists. Mm-hmm. And there are also documents, although I've seen different translations of these documents, but there are documents, even from times of King Hezekiah, it mentions that Hezekiah sent to the king of Assyria. He gave him koto takiltu, which some translate as being linen or cotton dyed blue. Now, the thing about the sea snail is that this dye doesn't attach to anything except for wool, which means this attests that there was blue and it was called tchelet, which did not come from this sea creature, from the murex.
So that's interesting. It popped into my head, Ezekiel 44, verse 18, it says, they shall have linen turbans on their head and linen trousers on their body. They shall not clothe themselves with anything that causes sweat, which is interesting. And certainly linen breathes very easily like cotton, but wool, not so much.
So again, the thing is that really, you know, linen clothing are actually a lot better. Actually, you have a whole bunch of friends that only wear linen. And I think it's a wonderful thing. And I actually can't get here in Israel. So if anyone has a very good source for linen clothing, please tell me. I'll go and buy there or order online. Because I can't find any linen shirts. And believe me, in the summertime, I seriously heavily suffer from the cotton.
Yeah, really? What do you mean?
It's hot. It's hotter. I mean, linen
breathes. The cotton's too hot. You need some linen.
We need some linen. Exactly. It's very difficult to get linen. I mean, I have a friend who wears only linen here in Israel, and he tells me, you know, there's a lot of fake fabrics out there that you buy. It's 50% linen or 60% linen, and the rest is polyester or cotton.
I hate that. Personally, I hate that. Well, it's just my personal preference to wear natural fibers, and particularly natural fibers that are woven in such a way that they breathe. I just like clothes that breathe. And linen is great for that. And loose woven cotton is great for that. But I don't know. Maybe I'm going to see you in a few weeks. Maybe I can find something. I'll bring it over. But
by the way, we're going to do the 3T tour.
We're going to do the 3T tour.
Couple of weeks. I'm hopefully going to meet a couple of very interesting people as well. Not sure how much time I'm going to be hanging out with you guys because it's very difficult to squeeze everything into a tour. There's nothing you can do about it. And I also have children, so, you know, I'm kind of busy.
Not just children, you have four. And once again, good day to Prince Olevi the Fourth. So listen, the priest is wearing, likely wearing the priestly garments, whether he's got the Urim and the Tumim, we don't know what exactly they are. But in any case, Shaul does say, withdraw your hands. Maybe, Yoel, maybe he had his... I understand that you were saying, stop that command, cancel that. Maybe he actually had his hands to pull out the Urim and the Thummim to make a decision. I don't know.
Exactly. This can also be a game of, you know, a Sofia Decha means cease, but also, you know, put your hands back. Don't stuff them in there to pull out the rocks. That's... That's wonderful. That's the basically, no, you just did something very, very important, that you're basically noticing nuances of how you play with words. That's a very, very important thing.
So it's a possibility. It's a possibility, but they do come into play a little bit later in the story, if we get to it this week. If you stop schmoozing, and then it says...
No, sorry. This is not called schmoozing. I'm giving information. This is part of the point of what we're doing here.
Now, it happened while Shaul talked to the priest that a noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Shaul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Shaul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was a very great confusion. Moreover, Yoel, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Now, I have a question about that. And I think you made a comment regarding that, I think, a couple of weeks ago. But just this week, my son was reading something. He's doing a little bit of research, Jonah, and he came up to me and he said, "Dad, the word infiltration, what does that word mean?" I said, what's the context, man? He goes, "Oh, I'm just reading about," he was reading about Mossad and something to do with Zimbabwe and that Mossad had infiltrated into the government or something or other. And when I read this, I thought to myself, I wonder, are these spies? Are these Hebrews that infiltrated into the ranks of the Philistines, and when it came time to turn on them, that's exactly what they did? Or are they deserters? Or are they people of the land that were living with the Israelites that weren't necessarily Israelites? Just, I don't know. But just remind us what your view is on this.
Okay, so first of all, the first option you gave, I seriously doubt if that's correct.
So they're not double agents?
I don't think they're double agents. No. We do have double agents that are on with David, but first of all, interesting that it actually says here, "Va'ivrim hayu laflishtim ke'etmol shilshom." And the Hebrews were to the Philistines, basically with the Philistines, ke'etmol shilshom, the ones that were kind of like in peace with them. But etmol shilshom means yesterday and 2 days ago, meaning in the past. Asher alu imam b'machane saviv, they actually were encamped with the Philistines. Basically, these were people that were living on the border, or maybe were in areas which were conquered by the Philistines, and they made peace with the Philistines. You have to remember, up to the point where there's a king, what unites the Israelites is the fact that they have a joint history and everything. But, you know, in certain situations, people will forget the unity of the 12 tribes. And we have this problem with the unity of the 12 tribes throughout history, and we're having the same problem today as well. Mm-hmm. People forget that we're brothers. And these were people who basically were recruited into the military campaigns of the Philistines, mm-hmm. and they were sitting inside the encampment of the Philistines. Now, there's a good possibility that Jonathan or Yonatan actually knew that these people were there, and he targeted an area where there won't be any Israelites. And he basically went up there. Now, the other problem is with the word Ivrim, is that the word Ivrim usually is related to, first of all, that's what the non-Israelites would call the Israelites. That's number one. You do have places where someone's referred as the Hebrew, like Abraham the Hebrew, Avraham HaIvri. But that's basically a name that was given to Abraham as the one that has come, and he doesn't really have any land here. So Ivri is probably also closely in there. There is a dispute about this. Some people disagree with this, but I do see the attraction to this understanding, mm-hmm. that Ivri is related to the word Afru or Apiru or Abiru, which are basically, it's not a nation, it's a social status that basically you are landless, because the Israelites, and even us today, the Arabs treat us like this, where they basically say, "You're not from here." And they do everything, and all these Palestinian supporters try to do everything to prove that Jews are not a real nation, and Israel is a Sepharist, and the Holocaust was made up, and we're just making things up, and we're just here, and we don't really belong here, and all these things. They were treated the same way even back then, and that was a treatment throughout the centuries, and this is why there's a lot of hatred towards Jews throughout the centuries. It's a historical thing. It's actually embedded in history, that this group of people, which were considered to be landless, and that's the concept of the apiru, which mean landless people, which mean they have no social status, mm-hmm. have come in to this land. So it's a possibility that what we have here is Hebrews, not only Israelites, but other ethnic groups that existed in the area that were under the power of the Philistines. And now that the Israelites are standing their own ground and battling against the Philistines, they say, okay, here's our chance to get rid of the Philistines. Let's join the Israelites. Mm. So it's possible these were Jews. They were kind of drafted
into the army reluctantly, so to speak, into the Philistine army, just because in that particular area from where they were from, the Philistines had greater influence. But when they see that the Philistines are potentially going to be defeated, they're like, now we have a choice. Let's fight against these guys as well. We don't like them. We prefer the Israelites. And so they turn on them. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And the reason I'm saying this is also, it says, "V'ha'ivrim ha'yu le'plishtim ketmol shishom." Use the word ivrim. And when you continue down the verse, it says, "V'gam hem alihiyot im Yisrael." It creates a contrast. There's the Ivrim and there's Israel.
Ah, that's true.
So there's a contrast here. So it's quite possible these were not Israelites.
That's a really good point. It says Hebrews joined the Israelites. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. There we go. So 22, likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard. They followed hard, Yoel, after them in battle. So Yehovah saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Bet Aven.
By the way, it says, "Vayidbeku gam hem acharem." Vayidbeku is from the word of davak, which is to glue. It's a translation of sticking. They stuck to them, basically chased them down hard. It's actually a very good translation. It's not a literal translation, but the translation itself conveys what it's actually saying. They glued them, so they stuck to them. They wouldn't let them go. You're running, I'm literally behind you.
I actually prefer that. I think that's really good. So they stuck to them like glue. I do prefer that because that has a lot more imagery to it. That's great.
Oh, you lose a lot of the imagery. I mean, again, let's take a very simple example. You go to Zephaniah 3, I think, and it uses Ekron Te'aker, Kritim Karet. It plays around with these words, where in the translation you can never do that. Mm-hmm. And there are places where you can. There are places you can do that. Places where you can't. For example, you have that where it says Ekron Te'akel. So Ekron was a Philistine city. Te'akel means it will be pulled out. It will be torn out of its place. Kretim also, again, these were related to the Philistines. They came from the Isles of Crete. The Philistines we're dealing with here are probably Greeks that came to this area, and we know that they did travel from Greece and the isles of Greece to this area as well. And they even brought their pottery with them, which helps us date certain things. And it says tikaret, which means to be cut off. It plays with that. Or you have also the story with Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esav. So Yaakov is from the word akev, yachaz be'akev achiv. He grabbed the heel. Mm-hmm. So Akev is the heel, but he's also stalling him. I love these little games. And Esav in Arabic means a hairy one. So he was born hairy. And I do know as a fact that there are babies who are born hairy. I've seen it. For example, the story when Jacob was selling Esau sold his rights of the firstborn.
Yes.
So it says, "Aiteni na min ha'adom ha'adom," as if from this red, red thing, "al keni karashemo Edom." He's called the red one. Or the red, but you don't see that. It's called Edom because you're translating it as an actual word, and you're not really translating what it's meaning.
And this is an opportune time to just remind everybody that the email for Hebrew lessons is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. hebrewinisrael@gmail.com if you want to get on the waiting list to have Hebrew lessons, quality Hebrew lessons with Yoel.
Actually, to go on the waiting list, what's happening now, if you don't want actual Hebrew lessons, what I'm doing now is that I'm creating a group, and we'll see how big it would be, and based on the size, the price will change. But what I want to do is create a group now that we're just going to read through the Bible based on the Hebrew. If there's anyone that already knows Hebrew, they can slightly practice their Hebrew during the lesson and stuff like that. And the whole idea is that we're going to study the Bible a bit more in depth than what we do here in Light of the Prophets. And actually, by the way, if there's anyone out there, Ira actually offered his service, but I want to see if there's a way of doing it without having to infringe on Ira's systems as well. Basically, I want to create a virtual class. So if there's anyone out there who understands how this stuff works, please contact me, because I am completely clueless about this stuff.
Sure.
If it's possible, if someone understands how these things work, I mean, it might be that I already have someone who can do, help me out with this, but if not, it would be nice if someone can, tell me, give me, here's a good website that you can use for creating a virtual class, and I can basically have my own platform, and we can do there and be, we can do a whole bunch of stuff.
So can they contact you if some people have some ideas on that and some experience there, Hebrew in Israel, they can contact you there?
Yeah, they can contact me either on the Facebook page or via the email. And that person will also be welcome to join the class if they want.
Cool. So we look forward to that. That's a good idea. I think you've mentioned that once before, so we'd love to see some progress there. So if anyone has some ideas in regards to that or be able to help you well with that and have some experience there, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, you can contact him there or on Facebook. It is, of course, Hebrew in Israel, the Facebook page.
I just bought my domain, by the way, as well.
Hey, excellent. So there's still a website on the way, so we'll stay tuned and you let us know when that comes about. We're up to 24. Now, look, the 23, well, it says, so Jehovah saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Bet Aven. But then the next verse says, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Shaul had placed the people under an oath, saying, cursed is the man who eats any food till evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. That's kind of dumb, right?
Yeah, so first, that's very, very dumb. You never do that. I actually served in the military, and the one thing we always said was the military marches, the army marches on its belly. If you're hungry, you can't function, specifically after a long battle. I remember we used to march for hours and hours and do this and do that and get very, very small meals. And then there was one meal that was big, that was reasonable, that had, you know, protein and everything. And that's the meal that kept us alive. You know, we had like little snacks and war rations and stuff like that. And then suddenly they come out of nowhere with this truck and they go for a week with this food, with war battle rations and everything. Mm. But you can also, suddenly this truck shows up with like a whole pile of food and you go like, yes,
And you got to stock up and then you got to keep your energy level up, right?
Yeah. So you actually, sometimes what you do is you should eat that kind of, if you're doing hard work, you should eat that meal in the evening. Mm-hmm. It prevents muscle deterioration. But in any case,
none of them had tasted food. This is something that Jonathan understands, by the way. None of them had tasted food. And the people of the land came to a forest and there was honey on the ground. Now, forest. Tell us about forest.
Your translation says people of the land. That's not really...
Oh, what do you got? What do you got?
First of all, there's a few interesting things. First of all, there's a collective here. It says, Ve'ish Yisrael nigas, and the man of Israel, which basically means the people of Israel who were there. Mm-hmm. Okay, Yohanan, I know you want to play with the toys, but I can't help you all the time. He's developed now. He's playing on the table. He used to play just on the floor. Now he's sitting on a chair and he's giving me the toys and I have to give it back to him. You know,
he's involving you. That's all right. You can do it.
Involving me at the wrong time. Anyhow, first of all, you have a collective here. Man of Israel basically means the people of Israel. Now you were saying, actually the Hebrew says in verse 25, V'chol ha'aretz ba'u v'yar. So it's using the word aretz or eretz, which means land, to refer to the people. So all the land came, which means all the people.
What did they come to? Mine says they came to, it says the people of the land came to a forest. Do you have forest?
Yeah, it says they came to a forest.
And there was honey? Are we talking about bee honey or in the forest, or are we talking about a beehive that has fallen, or are we talking about bee honey that is dripping from a hive? What can we take from this in the Hebrew?
First of all, just use the word dvash, and let me look very... And there's Ya'arat Advash. The problem is the Ya'arat Advash. A Ya'arat Advash is a honey cone. So it's quite possible this is actually bee honey. So we go back to the whole discussion, is bee honey kosher? The answer is that bee honey is not manufactured in the honey. There's a problem with it because we know it's manufactured in the bee's body, but it's not. It's a different system. So there is an ongoing discussion, is bee honey kosher or not? But we have another incident here, which it's plausible that we're dealing with bee honey because of the word Ya'arat Dvash, a honey cone. Because if this, for example, was fruit, like if you've ever seen, I don't know if you have any figs.
Yes, or fig honey or date honey or something like that.
Really good dates. But the thing is, dates don't grow in forests. Figs, on the other hand, can grow in forests. And if you've ever seen a really massive fig tree, they're pretty amazing. And what happens is that... It might be that these remember, I actually posted once on Facebook this whole thing about you have to puncture the, if you're taking care of figs, you have to puncture it because they can explode. That might be what happened here, that there were figs and they exploded and there was honey all over the place. The problem is that, okay, a fig explodes and it drips a bit, but how much honey can come out of that? So it's quite possible that this is a forest. And there were several beehives there, and they were knocked over in some way or another, and they scattered on the floor, and there's honey all over the place. Winnie the Pooh's favorite dream, all over the place. And this was actually bee honey. And they
I'm inclined to believe you. I think you're right. And I'll tell you why, because as we go on, and we may not get to it this week, but as we go on, there's the concern about you know, they're saying, oh, you can't slaughter the animals that way. You're going to eat the blood. You can't do it like that. There's that concern there in regards to diet. But when it comes to honey, no one's going, not so sure about that. That doesn't seem to be a problem. The reason why they're not eating it is because Shaul made them take this ridiculous oath.
In other words, no one's turned around to each other and says, Johannesen, nicht kosher. It's not kosher. Don't touch it.
It's none of that.
There's none of that going on. There's no some from ultra-orthodox Jew standing there with a sign saying, not kosher. No, you're not having that. They go in, they see the honey, and go like, oh, food. And Jonathan doesn't think twice. And it's obvious that they follow Torah because the contrast of the other story let's put it this. You do have a contrast, a problematic contrast here. The people ate whatever they saw, okay? Mm-hmm. Because basically you slaughtered the animals in an inappropriate way, which means it's possible that they weren't following Torah properly, and they ate honey, which is forbidden. But on the other hand, it's Jonathan who eats the honey.
True, and you got to acknowledge as well. Yeah, well, honey is not of the carcass of the bee. It's not from the body of the bee. The bee makes it, but it's not of the carcass of the bee. And it's not like you're eating the bee. I personally, I don't have a problem with it.
You should be very careful sometimes when you buy honey because sometimes you have bee parts in it as well.
Ooh, I've never seen that. Okay,
I've seen that. When you buy raw organic honey and all that stuff,
just make sure it's refined to a reasonable level. Anyway, hang on, I lost the microphone. Where are you?
Yeah. Disconnected. He walked by and grabbed the wire and disconnected everything. So there are questions. I mean, you can say, well, they ate the blood. Well, actually, by the way, what that means is another issue as well. We have to go into that as well. But questions here.
Let's see if we can get there, Yoel. I want to try and get to 35, and we're running out of time. So they went into the woods. Honey is dripping.
You're a nervous ninny.
They're going, honey, but they couldn't eat it because of the oath. But then Jonathan had not heard his father's because he wasn't there, right? He went with his armor bearer and his great victories. And anyhow, he catches up with the people, hasn't heard the oath, and he stretched out the end of his rod and he had some of the honey. He had the honeycomb. I got honeycomb here. Put it in his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. Then one of the people said, dude!
Because his eyes brightened. I've actually seen that happen when you have someone who hasn't eaten all day, and suddenly they sit down to eat. Like 10 minutes later, their eyes suddenly become awake, and they're the black energy. Circle. The energy comes back to them.
The energy comes back, and he said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" And you know, so the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. And now look at my. Does he say, 'Look how my eyes has brightened'?"
Yeah. I've got countenance, but is a plural. My eyes, einai.
I tasted a little honey. And how much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. And now that makes the point. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines, he says.
He's basically saying the opposite. Is like, yeah, we won the war. Let's fast. I mean, what's the point in that? Well, by the way, we have that in the culture I grew up in, which is kind of European. Mm-hmm. You know, every time something happens, oh, let's go fast. It's like, no, let's have a celebration. No, we're going to go fast.
Yeah. Okay. So now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ayalon. Is that right?
Ayalona. So yeah, Ayalon, Ayalona to Ayalon. Suffix that crosses the two somewhere.
Okay, okay. So the people were very faint, no doubt. I can understand it. Now, here's the problem, yo world. See, the pit. Now, I've got
okay,
a question.
Okay, okay, okay. Wait. There's a whole bunch of stuff, and we're probably going to finish with these verses. You have a question, but I have a lot to say about this.
I know you do. Now, don't forget, you've actually said a lot about this. And what I will do is I will re-release that particular conversation in regards to the issue of the fat and the blood. And you did go into quite a bit of detail. We don't have to go over it all again, but I'll release that in the newsletter as well.
I'll make a few points here. So it says the following. You just read now. Just read the verses all the way to the end of the section. We'll talk about everything, and you get to ask your question as well.
Okay. So this is what it says. It says that they were really hungry, and the people rushed on the spoil. They took the sheep and the oxen and the calves, yummy, and slaughtered them on the ground. I've got on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. And they told Saul, saying, look, the people are sinning against Jehovah by eating with the blood. Now, that's, you know, we know to go to Leviticus, we see that, and that's fine. Also Deuteronomy. And so he said, you have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day. Then Shaul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep and slaughter them here and eat. And do not sin against Jehovah by eating with the blood. So everyone... other people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there. And then Shaul built an altar to Yehovah. This was the first altar he built to Yehovah. Go for
it. So start off with your question.
Well, you know, this is the first time I've really thought about it, Yoel, because when I slaughter a goat, I just slaughter the goat out in the field. And I take a very, very sharp knife and I simply cut the throat. And it's all over within a matter of a minute or so, and the heart pumps the blood out, and it's that simple. Now, am I meant to be doing it on a rock? I don't know. What is this about?
So basically, it's not the issue that they were slaughtering literally on the ground. It's the fact that they're slaughtering the animals, mm-hmm. and they're not allowing the blood to drain. They're slaughtering, and it's like everywhere, and you're not hanging it up or something, let the blood drain, or you're not dragging it away from the blood. And what's happening is the blood's pumping out, but it's in a puddle, and the blood has nowhere to go, so it starts drying up, and mm-hmm. and there's blood that conjugates inside the system.
So basically, the
blood's not pumping out properly. Now again, I've been involved in when you slaughter goats and sheep and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and you can slaughter the animal on the ground,
mm-hmm.
okay. But here's another thing: they're slaughtering to the ground, and there's puddles of blood, and it says here, "Vayichlu ha'am al hadam." Now it doesn't necessarily mean that they're eating blood that's conjugated inside the system. What it also might mean is that they're eating next to the blood, that there's a puddle of blood, and they're now allowing the blood to stay there instead of allowing it to spread everywhere. So there's this puddle of blood there, mm-hmm. and it looks like a type of witchcraft they used in the Canaanite world. The issue of doing things with blood. You make a pit and you slaughter the animal and the blood's there and you manipulate the blood in some way that gives you omens and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That might be the issue. So this is why he's saying bring this rock, because when you slaughter on the rock, the blood it sprays, but it's everywhere. It trickles down. It doesn't stay in one place. It breaks the blood into different streams and goes everywhere instead of being like a whole puddle. That might be the issue. So it's not that they're eating blood. It's that they're eating next to the blood. Now, there's another question here regarding this altar that he's building. And this was the thing we had in the discussion we did like almost 2 years ago, I think it was.
Mm.
Almost like maybe 18, maybe even 20 months ago. Mm. That there's a discussion about, can you eat meat which is not sacrificial meat? And there were Karaite groups that believed that you're not allowed to eat any meat. Now, when I say meat, I mean four-legged animals, not birds and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about animals which were sacrificed, which mm-hmm. raises a question about pigeons, but pigeons don't really have that much blood. I mean, I've seen pigeons being slaughtered. It's like a few trickles and that's it. It's like, it spritzes out and that's it.
Mm.
But there is a discussion about this, and they say, oh, he built an altar to sacrifice upon, so this was actually a peace offering type of meat. This was the argument. They're eating meat, which is not sacrificial meat and stuff like that. But here's a simple question. First of all, there's no such thing as bringing sacrificial meat at nighttime. They're after battle, which means they've come in contact with the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So the chances of this being sacrificial meat is basically zero. On the other hand, what it says that he built an altar was that maybe after this incident, he went, and this is the first altar he built. It wasn't the rock. The rock was just to allow the blood to spread. But what he did was then he erected an altar because he was clean. There's a good option he actually was clean because mm-hmm. he didn't really venture into the battle, but maybe he did. You never know. He might have been a good king that actually goes ahead of the army instead of cowering in the back.
Maybe.
But that's where he erected the first altar because this was the real first battle that they fought. They had a battle earlier, but now it's really starting. Now we're fighting against the Philistines. What they did with the Ammonites, this wasn't the natural enemy. But mm-hmm. the Philistines were the natural enemy. The Philistines were the symbol of the enemy at the time. And they just had a battle against the Philistines and defeated them, which this is a big symbolic thing. Some warlord or king from Ammon that has issues with a certain very specific group of people, that's change. That's something simple. It's small money. We're talking about nothing here. But these mm-hmm. are the enemies. These are the symbol of the enemies that only vanished at the time of King David. But they've been bugging the people for decades.
Mm.
So now it's the reason to celebrate. We just had a battle with the Philistines, those scary Philistines, and we just defeated them. Let's build an altar, which is a natural thing everyone did. So this is what the last verse is saying. It wasn't related to the meat that we're eating. It wasn't related to the slaughtering. It wasn't related to the rock. It had to do with the concept of building an altar after a battle. We have that with the Amalekites. We have that erecting different things in different places. You have Samuel erects a rock and says, up to here, the Lord has helped us, and things like that. So you actually have to separate in your mind the story of the slaughter, story of the slaughter and the story of this altar. And these are two separate concepts.
Uh-huh. All right. That does help me. That helps me. And I wondered also, is it possible, and I appreciate the view that you take that it could be referring to blood next to and possibly looking like it's referring to or copying a pagan divination of some sort. Is it also possible, Yoel, I'm just wondering, and I don't really base this on anything, is it possible that they set upon the animals and killed them in a way that didn't drain them in their haste?
That's also very possible, but let's look at how the words are used. No, the word shachat is usually used for slaughtering by the neck. We also spoke about that last time as well.
That's right. True.
There's a difference between shachat and zevach, which rather is very, very important because it doesn't use the root zevach.
Mm-hmm.
Zevach is usually the word, well, again, it's sometimes used with great confusion in the Bible, but essentially when something's a sacrifice, the word is zevach, or if something is this meat that's consumed in everyday life, then it's shachat. Mm-hmm. But it's to eat meat, I mean, again, this is a celebration. To eat meat from a four-legged animal, from a cow, an ox, a sheep, and goat, and stuff like that, was pretty expensive. That was these things that they did only in special occasions.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have the loot from the enemy. Okay, this is free stuff. We're going to use that. We're going to utilize that for our food. Mm. But essentially, most of the time, people probably ate birds and maybe chickens. I don't know. Some people say chickens are not kosher. They ate mostly hunted birds and maybe deer as well if they were lucky and stuff like that. You know, the one packs and packs of deer running all over the place. I don't think that was something that was that common. It was common. I mean, I actually spoke with people who were living in Judea and Samaria back in the 50s and 60s, and they said that they were a lot more deer. I mean, it's not really deer. These are smaller animals, but were running around the mountains. It was easier to hunt them, and the Arabs overhunted them. So they're very rare. They're actually protected animals now. If you're caught hunting them, it's a pretty serious fine. You actually might be even sent to prison for it.
Wow, really? Is that right? Interesting.
Yeah, so they probably mostly ate, eggs and vegetables and bread. This way, by the way, the word bread, lechem, shows up mostly as a sign of food, sitting down and eating. Because lechem, the bread, was the main thing. You took your bread and you dipped it in everything. You had a piece of meat, you ate it with bread. You had some kind of vegetables, you took your bread and you dipped it. You had bread and you dipped it in vinegar, stuff like that.
Sure.
Obviously, they also had different grains. I mean, you can grind down things or smash them and make a porridge out of it. But that was a meal by itself.
Mm.
So eating wheat and barley and all these things was actually one of the main things that people ate in everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So what you're saying, though, the short of it is that I'm as long as I slaughter them properly with a sharp knife to the neck and the blood pumps, the heart pumps the blood out, it's okay if I don't do that on a raised rock.
Exactly. Okay. Well, that's the thing. A raised rock can sometimes also look like an altar as well. You have to be kind of careful with that.
Yeah. I don't have one anyway. The raised rock. So, all right. So that's good. So that's that. Thank you for your opinion there, because I would not have put two and two together there, and that's something interesting to consider. But we've done it. We've done it within the space of an hour, my friend. Once again.
I told you to trust me. You were so worried. Nervous ninny.
You've been listening to Truth to You, Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Thank you, my friend. And once again, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page, and HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. And just once again, if you have any experience with some kind of platform whereby Yoel can get a group going online where you can do a little bit of teaching, love to hear from you. And HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, you can contact him there as well. Thank you, my friend. Next week, we're going to be kicking off from 1 Samuel 14, verse 36, and see if we can't get to the end of chapter 14. But until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, kol tov.
Hey, nice one.
Yeah, I told you. You were worried. We won't put it in an hour. Stop schmoozing. Oh, shut up.